From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Norman Mailer has a big talent and a big ego. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about both. Mailer has a new novel about the CIA called Harlot's Ghost. Also today, Jake LaMar discusses his new memoir, Bourgeois Blues, about growing up black and middle class, attending integrated schools. He says the older he got, the more black and white people had certain notions of how his race should determine his choices in friends, lovers, and even clothes. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Low Life, Luc Santé's affectionate look at the underbelly of 19th century New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After several attempts by Republicans to put to rest doubts about Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, the confirmation vote has been postponed. The Senate is now negotiating how long to postpone the vote in order to more thoroughly investigate charges that he sexually harassed a former aide. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Majority Leader George Mitchell has appeared on the floor several times to procedurally delay the vote, which was set for 6 o'clock tonight. An aide to Mitchell says Democrats and Republicans are still divided over how much time is needed to investigate the allegations. Republicans agreed to the delay after a number of Democrats who had originally supported the nominee expressed doubts and demanded more time. Just before the vote was scheduled, Missouri Republican John Danforth announced Clarence Thomas's wishes to appear before the appropriate forum to clear his name. Republican Alan Simpson angrily said the delay does not show that the Senate takes sexual harassment charges seriously, but that the Senate will allow opponents of Thomas to continue a smear campaign against him. One senator said Democrats are pushing for a week delay in which to investigate the charges, and Republicans want only 1 to 2 days. An aide to Mitchell says the negotiators are still far apart. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The United States has reportedly complained to Israel about an alleged Israeli violation of Iraq's airspace. Diplomatic sources in Washington said the alleged violation took place 4 days ago when 4 Israeli warplanes crossed into northwest Iraq from Syrian airspace. U.S. officials reportedly warned Israel that its action could endanger the mission of U.N. inspectors who are monitoring the destruction of Iraq's nuclear and chemical weapons. In the continuing effort to clean up abuses of special privileges in the House of Representatives, Speaker of the House Tom Foley announced today that members will no longer be able to have the sergeant-at-arms reverse city parking tickets. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The new policy doesn't mean members won't be able to get parking tickets dismissed, but the Speaker's announcement today means that members who receive tickets must personally make their case that they were on official business. Members of the House are allowed to park anywhere with impunity if they're conducting business for the House. In January, the Senate eliminated its policy of allowing the sergeant-at-arms to intervene on behalf of senators who received parking tickets. In another development, the chairman of the House Ethics Committee, Ohio Democrat Lewis Stokes, said he wouldn't be able to take part in an investigation of members who wrote bad checks without penalties at the House bank. Stokes said he too had written bad checks, and he wanted to avert any appearance of impropriety. Last Thursday, the House voted to close the bank and have the Ethics Committee investigate the situation. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 21 points to close at 2,963. This is NPR. Secretary of State James Baker is planning another trip to the Middle East to complete plans for the proposed peace conference. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the secretary will leave late Saturday for visits to Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and Syria, and will also meet with Palestinians from the Israeli-occupied territories. Tutwiler said that, among other things, Baker wants to see the formation of a joint Palestinian-Jordanian delegation to the talks. In Philadelphia, prosecutors have withdrawn all criminal charges against 2 men accused of raping a Temple University student at a fraternity house last month. Tondaleah Wilder from member station WHYY reports.
The district attorney's office said it could not prove that the woman's role in the case was involuntary. The defendants, 22-year-old Raymond Evers and 23-year-old Michael DeRita, were arrested September 13th, the day after the alleged rape at the off-campus Alpha Phi Delta fraternity house. A 19-year-old female student told police that she had been gang-raped there. Evers and DeRita were the only suspects arrested. Defense attorney Charles Peruta called the woman a liar who had damaged the reputation of the two men. But Assistant District Attorney Diane Granlund said dropping the charges should not be construed as an exoneration of the fraternity members, who she said took advantage of a vulnerable woman. Meanwhile, Temple University has stripped the fraternity of its official recognition. For National Public Radio, I'm Tondalea Wilder in Philadelphia.
A witness at the trial of Manuel Noriega testified today that he saw the deposed Panamanian dictator accept $500,000 from the leaders of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel. The testimony came from a convicted drug dealer, Gabriel Toboada, who said that he saw the transaction at a meeting between Noriega and cartel leaders in Medellin in mid-1983. Toboada said that the Medellin drug traffickers paid Noriega to protect their drug shipments. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Mailer once wrote that before he was 17, he had formed the desire to be a major writer. Well, that wish certainly came true. He was famous at the age of 25 after the publication of his war novel, The Naked and the Dead. He won a Pulitzer and National Book Award for Armies of the Night, his reflection on the 1967 anti-war march on the Pentagon. He won a second Pulitzer for The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. And as novelist Scott Spencer recently wrote about Mailer, for a writer to inspire the controversy and divisions that routinely orbit Mailer's life and career is perhaps unprecedented in American literary history. Some of the controversies to which Spencer refers have been about Mailer's macho code, his feuds with feminists, his venture into politics, running for New York City mayor, and his championing of writer and convicted killer Jack Henry Abbott. But the main controversy around Mailer now seems to be whether his new book is too long and if it's any good. His novel Harlot's Ghost is an over 1,300-page epic about the CIA. That's just part one. A second volume is in the works. I asked Mailer where he sees Harlot's Ghost fitting into the spy novel genre.
Harlot's Ghost is really, I wouldn't say it's an anti-spy novel, but it is the opposite of spy novels. Spy novels are always highly plotted. There are notable exceptions. Jean Le Carré's A Perfect Spy would be one. But generally speaking, you measure the merit of a spy novel by how carefully it's plotted, how cleverly it's put together. You look for the kind of craftsmanship you find in a Swiss clock. And as a result, the characters in spy novels are usually thin or improbable because they have to obey the turns of the plot. And I've always liked to work in the other direction, which is have my characters take over a novel and let the plot suffer if it must, as it usually does, because in life, as we know, people tend to ruin every good plot that's forming. And the same thing does happen in a novel. And I think it's more interesting for me that way, because I read novels to learn a little more about life rather than more about mechanisms. And a highly plotted book is a mechanism.
With Volume 2 hanging over your head now, do you not feel the same sense of relief that you like to feel when you've just completed a novel?
Well, I haven't felt a sense of relief in a good many years. No, I've been writing one novel after another. I got myself into a situation which I'm not at all unhappy about, but it is there. I have 9 children, and I'm all too famous now for having been married 6 times, and so there's a bit of alimony to pay, and the children are all going through college or have gone through. But I have to earn a lot of money just to keep going, which is fine because I think I'm essentially lazy, and if I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't be writing as much. And ultimately, I'm happy I've written all these books, although I do groan and gripe all the while I'm working on them.
I think you were one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality, and to have that personality be, in a way, a part of your art. Do you think of yourself, or at least your public self, as being one of your greatest characters?
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. If I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. The sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. So the mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
But you did at some point, I think, almost make a decision to cultivate a public personality. On TV, you know, on the Cavett Show, on Merv, on David Susskind's show, you know, saying really provocative things. I mean, you even write in advertisements. I think it was an advertisement for myself about how you'd kind of like study TV to think about how you could best come across on it, and to most kind of accurately get across the thought or the emotion that you wanted to.
Yeah, but I've given up on that. I don't think you can communicate through TV. Some people may be able to, but I can't. My ideas are too
complicated.
Yes, too complicated, too full of too full of nuance. When you start trying to communicate through TV, or for that matter through newspaper stories, your remarks get garbled and bizarre. I mean, whenever I read a story about myself, I generally shudder a bit. I say, oh, what a bizarre, ugly, sort of off-balance person I appear to be in that story.
If you're just joining us, Norman Mailer is my guest, and his new novel is called Harlot's Ghost. You used to always measure yourself against other writers. In advertisements for myself, you wrote, "It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill." Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, novelists may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, oh, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. It'll be a most special and peculiar activity almost, because I think television is driving everything else out.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
To many younger writers, you've become a father figure, and I wonder what that's brought out in you, different from the competitive instinct that you always had toward writers of your own generation.
Well, I'm not competitive anymore, because I'm beginning to recognize that what's important is that we keep writing novels, that the 20 or 30 or 40 writers in America who have real talent keep working and keep doing more and more, because I think we're the only people who can define the country, and I think we have a duty. So I think it's good when any one of us breaks through and does a good book or a rich book. We help the others. I wish the level of our writing was as high, let's say, as the writing in Latin and South America. I mean, they have great writers there, any number of them, four, five, six you could name. And I'm not sure that we do anymore.
Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual. And you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then-wife's father had been a professional fighter. And whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, "Come on, let's put on the gloves." He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly and the hard way. And then after that, I got interested in it and did more and more boxing. And then I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years, and I've boxed with him a great deal. At one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe, because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I could answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time. It's stultifying to be a novelist unless you keep opening up working with larger and larger, not necessarily larger and larger canvases, but either larger canvases or more powerful themes.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't. I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle-class neighborhood. But I do think that the what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years. And the shock of that, and then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity, and that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. Young people at Harvard. Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. We were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life, and everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice, and even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob, and... So that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier. And I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
In what way weren't you a good soldier?
I just resented close-order drill completely. I don't think I ever learned to march properly or present arms or any of that stuff. And I just wasn't a particularly good soldier. If you had 12 soldiers in a platoon, I'd be the third or the fourth from the bottom.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch. Maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with... characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through my ego was battered. And I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing. But I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years that I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You said your ego was on the elevator, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship, just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. They keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing. They're not going to stop me. And you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially, and so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
Huh. Norman Mailer is my guest, and he has a new novel about the CIA called Harlot's Ghost. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Norman Mailer is my guest. You know, you might be one of the few major writers of your generation who is Jewish and for whom Jewishness hasn't been a major theme in your fiction. Do you think that's true, that you're one of the few?
Yes, and I think it hasn't been a major theme, but I think on the other hand, it's informed every sentence I've written. You know, being Jewish is a state of mind. It's a way of receiving life and perceiving it and evaluating it, and it affects every one of one's judgments. It affects one's style. In fact, it was Norman Podaritz, once remarked many years ago that there were two kinds of Jews in history, he felt, if one were to speak very generally. One was the essentially Orthodox Jew who returned to tradition and was deeply enmeshed in it and thought of himself or herself as a Jew and primarily a Jew and always a Jew. And then there was the Jew who became the mirror of the time and aped the manners of all those people who were not Jewish, didn't copy them literally, but became so sensitive to the manners of those who are not Jewish that he might end up knowing more about it than they did. One example of this is, although he was not Jewish, his parents were Jewish. Disraeli is a wonderful example of that. He didn't look British, but he was more British. He was more English than the English. So in that sense, I think I would belong to that second category. I've always been interested in writing about things that are not Jewish precisely because I half understand them and I want to know more about them. But I think that, I've never said to myself, well, I'm really not Jewish. I know damn well how Jewish I am.
I think that kind of is consonant with the image of the writer as spy. You know, the writer is always looking at the people who he's not a part of.
Well, that's very good, by the way. You know, the writer is spy. I think in a way, writing about the CIA couldn't have been more natural for me because I've been a spy all my life. So I can understand spies.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well, just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just, I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth. Whatever. It's hard for me to talk about a good review after all. A man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. How the hell can they read?
I wonder if you think that the best aspects of the women's movement, the most open and least doctrinaire, have affected your view of women or your view of yourself as a man.
Oh, no question. It's been going on now for 20 years, and it's had a huge effect, some for the good and some for the bad. I think what women are maybe beginning to face now is as they gain equality with men, they're also going to be taking on all of men's problems. And a great many of men's problems are just dreary. And on top of that, since men have been, in effect, wrecking the world, let's speak ecologically, look what man has done to the natural world, the question is, once women become equal to men, are they going to then begin to direct the world into better places? There's very little evidence of that so far. One's idea of women's liberation at this point is women in trim, gray business suits carrying small attaché cases working as high executives. Isn't that the general perception of what women's liberation is about these days? That at the very least, even the most hidebound corporation has to have its token woman in a high office?
It's one narrow part of it. I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, "Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss." Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you're very often freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much, because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. You know, I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
So how has that changed your public life, the public Norman Mailer?
Well, I'm much quieter now. You know, a lot of people complain secretly. They say, well, you know, Norman has gotten so mellow, he's boring. But I'm not at all the public figure that people think I am. You know, I haven't been in a fight in it must be 15 years. I stopped boxing 8 years ago. I'm a man of 68.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
Talking about
the process.
Yeah. Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had when I in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm much better editor of my own work. I'm sure that any number of reviewers would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
And my guest has been Norman Mailer, and his new novel is called Harlot's Ghost. It's a novel about the CIA. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As an African American growing up during the Civil Rights Movement, writer Jake LaMar didn't have to face the overt racism that his father did. But he did face what he calls crypto-racism. He faced it growing up, going to an Ivy League college, and working as a reporter at Time magazine. Coming up, we talk with Jake LaMar about his new memoir, Bourgeois Blues. And if you think New York City is dangerous now, wait until you hear what it was like a century ago. Maureen Corrigan reviews Luke Sante's new book, Low Life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Senate leaders continue to confer behind closed doors on the timing of a vote on the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. That vote had been scheduled 1.5 hours ago, but in the wake of allegations of sexual harassment by a former aide of the nominee, a number of senators called for a delay on the vote. In fact, the major Senate backer of the nomination, Republican Senator John Danforth, proposed that the vote be postponed for 2 days. Earlier, Senate GOP leader Robert Dole said that his vote count on the nomination showed 41 senators ready to vote approval, 41 against, and 18 senators not decided. The White House has been standing behind its nomination of Judge Thomas, defending the nominee and indicating that it wanted the Senate to vote as scheduled. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
The administration has stood firmly behind Judge Thomas, even as it became apparent that momentum was building in the Senate to delay the confirmation vote. Reporters camped outside the White House spokesman's office were startled when President Bush walked down the corridor this afternoon. Asked if he was sticking with Judge Thomas, Mr. Bush responded, "You're darn right." He did not answer further questions, but earlier said that his faith in Clarence Thomas had wavered not one iota. The White House says the president was aware of the charges of sexual harassment against Judge Thomas and dismissed them. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Judge Thomas is a man of integrity and deserves better treatment than he's been getting. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Secretary of State James Baker leaves for the Middle East again this week in a new effort to arrange a peace conference for that area. It will be Baker's 8th trip to the Middle East since the Persian Gulf War. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said he had received a draft of the invitation to the peace conference. But speaking to the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, Shamir said the final version of the invitation has still not been agreed on. He also said that Secretary Baker has promised that the invitations will not be sent without Israeli agreement. The main problem remains who will represent the Palestinians. Palestinian leaders Faisal Husseini and Hanan Ashrawi are planning to leave tomorrow for Washington for another in a series of meetings with Secretary Baker. The two were questioned by police today on the charge of breaking the law against meetings with the PLO. They reportedly traveled to Algiers to address the Palestine National Council. Husseini and Ashrawi would not tell police whether they had gone to Algiers. They only said they did not break the law. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 21 points to close at 2,963.77 on volume of some 170 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Alaska has accepted a $1 billion settlement in connection with the Exxon Valdez oil spill 2 years ago. The judge also accepted guilty pleas from Exxon and its shipping division and approved a $900 million civil settlement and $125 million in fines. The judge said that the oil company's effort to pay some civil claims and its summer work to clean up Prince William Sound were the most important factors in his ruling. This settlement ends all state and federal litigation over the 1989 accident, but has no effect on individual civil lawsuits. In Miami, defense attorneys for former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega requested a mistrial this morning, contending that government prosecutors are poisoning the jury with testimony about Noriega's personal life that is not relevant. Melissa Mancini has more.
Attorneys for Noriega filed a mistrial on the grounds the evidence presented in the former dictator's drug trafficking trial was unrelated to the case. At issue is the testimony of a former drug pilot who said part of the Medellin cartel's payoff to Noriega involved six French prostitutes. Defense attorneys argue the alleged incident is in no way tied to the crimes Noriega's charged with and that the testimony was prejudicial and inflammatory. U.S. prosecutors challenged the testimony helped establish the relationship Noriega had with the cartel, that he not only knew them, but liked them, and established a social relationship with them as well. The judge has yet to rule on the mistrial request. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Officials in Tokyo say that Japan will give $2.5 billion in more aid to Moscow to help the Soviet Union in difficult financial times. A Japanese official says that food is generally in short supply in the Soviet Union. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a growing body of African-American writing that describes the experience of growing up black and middle class in America. My guest Jake Lamar is one of the younger writers to complete a book on the subject. His new memoir is called Bourgeois Blues. He left his job at Time magazine to write the book. Here's a passage from the opening chapter.
For me, the lines between the black and white worlds had always been blurred. Growing up, I took my race for granted. I was born in 1961 during the heyday of the civil rights movement. At school, I was taught African American history and read African American literature. At home, I was bred to believe that I was at least the equal of any other person, black or white. I enjoyed advantages that most blacks of my father's generation and many of my own could only have dreamed of. A middle-class upbringing, a private school education, a Harvard degree, a job writing on national affairs at Time magazine. I tried to live my life by Dr. King's credo, judging people not by the color of their skin but by the content of their character. And I simply assumed that all reasonable human beings did the same. But the older I got, the more I found that the color of my skin was the dominant factor in how people judged me, and judgments were getting harsher all the time. Black and white people alike had certain notions about every aspect of my life, how I should dress and talk, how I was supposed to choose my friends and lovers, where I should live, how and what I should write. There were black people who saw American life as a perpetual race war and expected me to choose sides. There were white people who presumed that what I wanted was to be just like them and who were dismayed to learn otherwise. "You know what your problem is, Jake," a black friend once said. "You're too white for black people and too black for white people." I began to wonder, was I some sort of freak?
You write that your parents' attitudes towards race often confused you. On the one hand, you were prohibited as a child from watching The Little Rascals because the images were so racist. But on the other hand, your parents would say things about ignorant niggers and loud, nappy-haired women, and you could never quite figure this out.
Yeah, it's a curious contradiction, I think, for people who were coming up at that time. The negative images that were imposed on them in their youth, they tried to fight against them as they grew older, but I think there was still some residue of that sort of discomfort and prejudice against their own people.
You wrote something interesting about your experiences in private school, and that is that you found that in some circles, being black was almost an advantage because for a lot of the white students, you know, black was really hip, so it was really cool to have black friends.
Right. Oh, yeah. You were just instantly considered cool, you know, just by virtue of being black.
What were the advantages and disadvantages of that for you?
Well, I think to a certain extent, it was assumed that I may have had a street smartness that I never had. You know, I was always, especially in the first 12 or 13 years of my life, a pretty nerdy kid. I didn't consider myself hip at all. But that white kids did consider me, you know, somehow, or expected of me a street smartness that I didn't have. It was just one of the first times that I ran into this sort of strange conflict between what others perceive you to be and what you really are. In a way, it was fine. I didn't mind, you know, to a certain extent, I didn't mind the coolness that was expected from me, yet I couldn't really always deliver either, so.
You moved to Riverdale, a very prosperous area in the New York area, and you write that there, for the first time, you realized you were starting to terrify ordinary pedestrians.
What was the kind of response that you're referring to there?
Well, it's just this bizarre thing, and you know, every black male I know has experienced this at one time or another in a city. I write in the book about walking down the street on a sunny morning, my book bag slung over my shoulder, and I would see a somewhat elderly white pedestrian ahead of me. As they sensed my presence, they would turn, and soon as they got a look at me, a terror would flash in their eyes. They would stop dead in their tracks and stare wide-eyed at me as I passed, you know, virtually paralyzed with fear. This was the strangest thing, one of the strangest things I'd ever experienced at that point, but it became a more and more common thing and something that happens to this day. You know, the reaction is not always as extreme, but you might stop to ask a person directions on the street and then they're sort of recoiling. I think there is this fear of young black men.
What did that bring out in you?
At first, just dismay, eventually a sort of anger, and now it's one of those petty annoyances that you try to have roll off your back. But I talk about a friend of mine who I grew up with, my best friend, who is a very tall person, a child of an interracial marriage, and he would really terrify the people. And he said, you know, that when we were 16, he said, it makes me want to mug them. I mean, if that's what they think I'm going to do. I mean, he's one of the most gentle people I've ever met. He would never do harm to another person. Yet it provoked this anger in him that they would have this expectation that they would not, you know, bother to see him as an individual, but as some sort of terrifying stereotype.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jake LaMarre, and he's written a memoir called Bourgeois Blues, an American Memoir. And he's a former reporter for Time magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jake LaMarre, author of the new memoir, Bourgeois Blues. You went to Harvard, and in your book you describe Harvard as a dull, cold, segregated place. Mm-hmm. How so?
I didn't ever really have a sense at Harvard that I never had the sense of community that I had expected there, and I found that at Harvard people just sort of function in their own little pockets. This was true to a certain extent at high school, but my high school was so small, and I think there was a sort of an effort was made to have more mingling across different groups. At Harvard, people really kept to their own cliques, and those cliques were defined by different things, you know, by ethnicity or by social standing or by extracurricular interests. But I found that it was a place where people really stayed in their pockets, and it was not a warm place at all.
Did you feel that a lot of white people were always asking themselves, well, is he here because of affirmative action? Will he ever really measure up?
It wasn't a sense that I got personally a lot, though it did happen. I had one teacher in English class in particular who just... you know, it's funny, this sort of what I call a crypto-racism. You know, people aren't openly insulting to you. Nobody is ever, you know, called me a nigger or burned a cross on my doorstep. But there is this condescension and this way in which people will patronize you. And anyone, you know, with an ounce of awareness knows when they're being patronized. But when a black person feels that a white person is condescending to them, it's often dismissed as oversensitivity or some sort of paranoia. Yet it's such a strong and obvious feeling that you have. And I did get that from one teacher at Harvard in particular.
How did you deal with it?
I actually talked to him about it. I wanted to know if there was some weirdness between him and me, because he didn't seem to take seriously a lot of the things I was saying, and I'd always been a pretty successful student. the reaction was one of total surprise on his part, and he said, "Well, no, there wouldn't be anything at all. I don't think I've done that at all." And after that point, he seemed to sort of go in the other direction, went out of his way to be nice and attentive, you know. And in the whole dozy do, it's just sort of irritating that someone just can't be normal, you know.
With Time magazine, you wrote a piece that you had intended to title Native Sons, and it was about inner-city black men. You weren't happy with the way the piece was edited.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference between how you conceived of the piece and how it finally came out?
Well, the one thing, the main thing that disturbed me was the intro about an individual we wrote about in the story, and I attempted to convey all the vicissitudes of his life and to get that to illustrate the broader points of the piece. It was cut down so that only the bare facts of his life came across, that he was 23 years old and was serving a life sentence for taking part in a robbery that resulted in the death of the owner. It was not said in this edited version that he wasn't accused of pulling the trigger but was sentenced to life imprisonment anyway, or that he was attempting to do something with his life at that point. I felt that a complicated story about an individual in extenuating circumstances was boiled down to a sort of punchy, scary caption, and I think that that's usually the way black males in the inner city are presented.
When your story was published, the pub letter, that thing near the table of contents, that's a behind-the-scenes look at one of the
letter from the publisher, yeah.
Yeah, and it's behind-the-scenes story of one of the stories in the magazine that week. And so you were quoted in that letter, since the letter was about your story, you were quoted as saying that you were reminded that you were fortunate to grow up in a two-parent home and that you had access to good education. When you read that quote back, when the magazine came out, you were really horrified. What bothered you about what you had said?
Well, it's the whole, you know, it's this sort of constant ambivalence. You know, there was nothing untrue about what I said. I was did feel grateful to have grown up in relatively privileged circumstances. Yet I felt that, you know, with my clean-cut visage in the pub letter, I felt as if I was being set up as some sort of contrast with the native sons, the sort of poor and, you know, more threatening black males whose pictures appeared later in the magazine and who were shot against brick walls and barbed wire. And I felt that I was being sort of set up as a quote non-threatening unquote alternative, and it made me really uncomfortable. And I think this is the ambivalence a middle-class black person feels a lot of the time, you know, that we're sort of being held up as examples of nice blacks while being contrasted in a really unflattering way with the less privileged.
Let me bring up a kind of complicated issue. The way you describe your father, there was a period of his life when it seemed like your father was kind of particularly tempted by white women, as if white women were a kind of special, like, gourmet dish or something. And you've been involved in relationships with white women over the years and wanted to make sure no one would, you know, perceive it as that kind of thing. And I wonder what kind of difficulties that whole thing created for you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like your mother, for instance, you were afraid that your mother would see your relationships with white women because of the way she perceived of your father's interest in white women.
Yeah, I think my father, when I was growing up, as I say in the book, used to sort of taunt my mother by leering at white women on TV or on the street. I don't know if I would say that he was tempted by a lot of white women, but he did have one long-standing affair with a white woman. And as I say in the book, there was a rapport between them. There was a genuine affection between them, or at least coming from my father, that I never sensed with my mother. The woman he was involved with was very tough and aggressive, like my father. And I think on some level, they just related as people in a way that my mother and father never did. But I also sensed in my father's relationship with his mistress that her being white was a sort of a bonus, and that it, and that for him, it sort of signified a way in which he had arrived, in a way that he had risen above his humble, segregated beginnings. For me, it was always different having grown up around white people, and I just, you know, I think related to people on a more individual basis, and didn't, you know, I write about being a kid and having a crush on two different girls in my parochial school, one black, one white, and it really never made a difference to me.
Even though it wasn't an issue for you having an interracial relationship, did you feel it was an issue for the people around you, you know, in ways that would make you self-conscious, even though you weren't self-conscious within the relationship itself?
Well, this is the thing, you know. I mean, I always liked to think that I wasn't self-conscious in the relationship itself. And I write in the book about a woman I was involved with for 3 years. And, you know, we sort of contemplated marriage. You know, and it was never anything that we were, you know, about to do. But I always sort of shied away from the issue. And a year and a half after we'd broken up, she said to me that she thought that my breaking up with her was a failure of nerve. And I thought she meant, well, you know, the nerve to get married, because, you know, I you know, wasn't ready to make a commitment like that. But she emphasized that it was that she thought I didn't have the nerve to marry a white woman. And I had never really thought about that and didn't think that there was that sort of reluctance on my part, thought that race was, would not have been that big an issue for me, but I had to wonder if it really was. And I think there was this sort of sense that if I were to marry a white woman, that would be some sort of betrayal or something that I really wasn't ready to do. And I think that sort of racial stigma might have been deeper in my consciousness than I ever realized.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Jake Lamar's new memoir is Bourgeois Blues. This is Fresh Air. Coming up on All Things Considered, the latest developments in the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. In the wake of this weekend's charges that Thomas sexually harassed a former employee, Thomas himself asked that today's Senate confirmation vote be postponed for 48 hours. All Things Considered, we'll have today's debate in the Senate from legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and from Elizabeth Arnold on Capitol Hill. Also, a debate on what are the appropriate areas of investigation into the life of a nominee to the High Court. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Headlines about many American cities have grown worse and worse over the past few years. New York is probably the most extreme example. But in a new book called Low Life, Luke Sante claims that New York never was Fun City. He says that everyday life for many New Yorkers was just as perilous in the 19th century. Low Life may offer cold comfort to contemporary urbanites, but commentator Maureen Carrigan says that it also offers an astonishing tour of old New York.
Reading Low Life is like inhabiting the world of those photographs that Jacob Riis took in the 1880s for his famous book, How the Other Half Lives. Riis captured the images of invisible New Yorkers, sweatshop girls, river thieves, and street urchins. In Low Life, Luke Sante follows Riis's subjects out beyond the static frame of their photographs. He trails them into the nickel lodging houses where they slept. He shoves his way into the pits of the Bowery theaters where they threw chicken bones at bad actors. And he slinks into the waterfront dives where they drank cocktails of raw whiskey and camphor. Low Life recreates the brutal circus of 19th century New York, a world that writers like Edith Wharton and Henry James were too refined to notice. Sante got the idea for writing Low Life while he was living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He says he became curious about the people who lived in the tenements during the period when they were being built, from around 1840 to 1919. Sante didn't want to write another academic social history of New York. nor did he want to write about honest and hard-working immigrants. Instead, he dove feet first into what he calls the accumulated mulch of the city. Sante sinks down through layers of time and sin to rediscover night spots like the Slide on Bleecker Street. It opened in the 1870s and was probably the first openly gay bar in the city. The worst dive in the 1890s was a place called McGurk's Suicide Hall. Its sick popularity derived from the fact that lots of prostitutes killed themselves on the premises. If you're interested in encounters with the grisly past, the building still stands near Houston Street. Some bars, like the Fourth Ward Hotel, thought dead customers might be bad for business, so it had trap doors through which corpses could be dropped directly into the East River. Sante says that an historical amnesia governs the view of drug use in New York, making it seem like a recent phenomenon. In fact, opium and cocaine dens flourished in the 19th century. One place, the Lafayette Hotel on West 40th Street, was especially popular with customers who used crystallized cocaine, nicknamed Bernie. Sante describes a potted tree in the back room of the Lafayette called the Bernie Tree. Its branches were garlanded with hundreds of black rubber tubes used for snorting. Sante also unearths wild stories about the gangs who once controlled the streets of New York, the Roach Guards, the Plug Uglies, the Dead Rabbits, and, of course, the Bowery Boys. A gang called the Wyos even published a menu of their services. For $2, you could hire them to punch somebody's eye. For $15, they'd chew off an ear. And for $100, they do the big job. Sante's underground excursion into old New York depravity tries to be relentlessly anti-nostalgic, but somehow I just can't believe that these quaintly named gangs and clip joints were as bad as the horrors that threaten the city these days. Maybe I've seen too many Hunts Hall and Leo Gorcey movies. Low Life resurrects a New York that's seamy, anarchic, and mesmerizing. You might not want to live there, but you certainly want to visit.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with associate producers Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. Joel and the band will be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow night to play at Blues Alley. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Israeli scholar Mark Heller and Palestinian scholar Sari Nusseibeh spent months debating a formula for a lasting peace in the Middle East. On the next Fresh Air, Heller and Nusseibeh discuss their two-state solution. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.